Welcome to Be Happy, a podcast discussing all things related to hepatitis B. This is part two of the International HBV Meeting Interview Series, in which Edward Tate, Director of Communications at Hepatitis B Foundation, interviews scientists and researchers at the 2023 International HBV Meeting in Kobe, Japan.
I'm Alan Per-Rulson, a senior fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and also an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute.
Thank you. You gave a keynote at this meeting talking about your research. It's quantitative research, isn't it? Could you give us sort of a quick summary of what that work is about?
Yes, so you do a mathematical modeling of viral infections. I look at the dynamics of what goes on within individual people who are infected by viruses. We try and quantify the amount of virus that you can detect in blood or tissues, and also their immune responses to it, what the dynamics of that immune response are, and then try and deduce what's controlling the viral growth and why the virus is growing as it does, how fast it grows, does it come back down again, are antibodies involved, are T cells involved, are cytokines involved. And a lot of the work involves looking at the patterns, the kinetic pattern of how virus levels change within a person's blood, because it's very easy to measure that. And it can be very diagnostic of what's going on both within the virus and the host response to it.
Is this data valuable for basic research, for drug development, for patient treatment? Where's the most frequent application?
I'd say it's valuable for all three. The most frequent applications in basic research gives us clues as to what's going on. It's been picked up and used in drug development, and I think the case in which it's been most important has been hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. So hepatitis C, as many of the hepatitis viruses, it has very limited animal models. A major one is chimpanzee, and one can't do experiments in chimpanzees anymore. So mm-hmm. It's not a good animal model for hepatitis C. If one looks at a hepatitis C chronically infected patient and measures the amount of virus in their blood, mm-hmm. It turns out that once they're chronically infected, it's relatively constant. We say it reaches a set point. Mm-hmm. However, then if you treat them with an antiviral drug or one that's a candidate drug, and you'd like to know if it's effective or not, what was done before we got involved is you'd run a clinical trial, mm-hmm. and you'd give the patient the drug usually for at least 12 weeks if you could, maybe even 1 year, and see how the patient responded. And the 12-week mark was somewhat indicative of how they would respond after a year of therapy. But that's an enormously long period of time. Mm-hmm. And based on earlier work that we had done with HIV that showed that the virus replicates very, very rapidly and also can be decreased very rapidly with drugs, got a collaboration with Tom Layden at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and he put patients on the therapy that was available at the time in the 1990s, which was interferon, mm-hmm. and dosed them daily, although it wasn't very common at that time. And also followed our paradigm from HIV and sampled them quite frequently. So in fact, they were hospitalized, a line was put in. And what we discovered is that the viral levels fell very, very rapidly, usually after about an 8-hour delay after they started on therapy.
It's amazing.
And they would fall 10 to 100 fold over the following day or two. And then I developed some theory about that, and we determined that from the magnitude of that fall, So over the first 2 days, you could quantify how effective the test drug was in blocking the viral replication. And we call that the effectiveness of the drug.
So you were able to, in a very short order.
And so that really, I'm told from a variety of drug companies, that instead of doing both animal studies or long-term studies, they could look at candidate drugs in humans over very short clinical trials. Subsequent to that, there was the first clinical trial of one of the HCV protease inhibitors. 2 days of drug, first in an animal model, then in people, and then they stopped the drug and the virus rebounds, and you could measure what an estimate of how effective that compound would be.
That's amazing.
Right, so that was a big development of an example of how theoretical understanding of what's going on could lead to changes in drug development.
In your observation, does the hepatitis B virus behave quite differently than the hepatitis C virus?
Yes. Hepatitis B is a totally different virus, even though they both infect the liver. Hepatitis C has a positive strand RNA genome, a single strand, mm-hmm. replicates only in cytoplasm. And what's interesting about C is that if you can stop the replication of the virus, then the cell has enzymes that can degrade the RNA genome. So you can actually cure a cell that's infected by HCV, and subsequently you can cure patients.
Right.
Hepatitis B is a DNA virus, so its genome is quite stable as opposed to the RNA of hepatitis C. The DNA also moves into the nucleus of the cell, interacts with histone proteins, and becomes a sort of a mini chromosome. So it's a very, very stable object. And cells that are infected with hepatitis B are infected for their lifespan, just as in the case of HIV, where the RNA in the HIV genome gets reverse transcribed into DNA and then gets brought into the nucleus of the cell and integrates into the chromosome. And again, in HIV, once a cell is infected with HIV, it's infected for the life of the cell. So HIV and hepatitis B have some similarities, and they're both very difficult to cure.
Yeah.
Or HCV, it was really a quite different case.
That's a fascinating distinction. I actually have never heard someone compare the similarity of HIV and B and the difference with C. That's fascinating. I'm sure you may be tired of people mentioning AI and its impact on your work, but you were doing quantitative work long before AI was available. How's it impacting this advanced computing and AI impacting your work?
Personally, it hasn't very much so far. Some of my younger colleagues who sort of adopted that are sort of moving in that direction, and it allows one to look at much larger data sets mm-hmm. and handle them. Most of the work that I've done, which is, as I said, basic research and involves analyzing clinical trial data, has been under very small studies where patients are looked at very intensively. So I'd rather model 5 to 10 patients, which are sampled very, very frequently, and lots have been done on them, as
right.
opposed to looking at a trial with hundreds of patients, and the data obviously has to be much more sparse when you're dealing with large populations.
You've worked, I'm sure, with other viruses and illnesses and so forth. How does B compare to the other illnesses, diseases that you've looked at?
Well, B is one of the most complicated and surprising viruses. It's the smallest one that we've worked with. It has a genome of a 3,500 kilobases, 3,500 bases, which is about a third the size of the genomes in HIV, hepatitis C, influenza, Zika virus, which we worked with. And yet it's more enigmatic. It's got a crazy life cycle.
Enigmatic as in puzzling.
Puzzling, yes. So if your listeners don't know, its genome, as I said, DNA, but it's two strands of DNA, and it forms what's called a relaxed circular DNA. The two strands aren't closed circles.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of three-quarter circles, and it base pairs where they overlap. That virus goes into a cell that genome is transported into the nucleus of the cell where the DNA repair enzymes complete the circles and make what's called covalently closed circular DNA, which is a much more stable form. And then that interacts with proteins and forms these mini chromosomes.
So that makes it a more formidable entity.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then that mini chromosome acts like a normal chromosome, and it makes, it's transcribed, makes messenger RNAs. It makes one full, it can also make a full transcript of the whole genome. That's called pregenomic RNA.
Okay.
And that's exported out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm, at which point it interacts with some of the proteins that are also being made in the nucleus, a polymerase and something called a capsid protein.
Right.
And the polymerase then takes this RNA genome and reverse transcribes it back into DNA. So it makes one strand of DNA, and that same polymerase then copies the one strand of DNA into the second strand of DNA to make this relaxed circular molecule again. So it has the reverse transcriptase activity of an RNA retrovirus like HIV, and swaps back and forth between genomes of RNA and DNA.
That's amazing.
So it's an extremely complicated life cycle. And then what's even more interesting was once it makes this relaxed circular DNA in the cytoplasm, some of it gets enveloped and is secreted as a virus because that's the genome of the virus particle. But some of this relaxed circular DNA within the cytoplasm, in a sense, is looked at by the cell as if it's got infected again, and it gets transported back into the nucleus.
Yes.
And so instead of just having one mini chromosome, you can then have two or three. In some animal models, is that the hepatitis B virus.
Right.
And in that model system, ducks can have 50 mini chromosomes by this recycling pathway.
That's amazing.
Humans usually have much smaller numbers, sort of on average 1 to 3, although some of the single cell work now is detecting some cells are sort of jackpot and can have many more copies.
Wow.
But it's an extraordinarily complicated process, which we don't fully understand. The virus also has been called a stealth virus, because it's very difficult for the immune system to detect it.
It hides, it lurks.
It hides from the immune system.
Yeah.
So
that's fascinating.
A lot of challenges for us.
You've been coming to this meeting for a lot of years, participating in this meeting for a lot of years. How do you feel in general about the state of research in hepatitis B today versus when you started participating in this meeting?
Well, I think what's exciting is that the pharmaceutical companies finally have decided to take an interest in trying to cure hepatitis B. And a lot of the companies that had worked on hepatitis C, which, as I said, is an early, easier target, once it essentially has been cured, decided that hepatitis B is the next target and go after it.
Right.
And for decades, really, the only therapies, in fact, the only approved therapies still, are reverse transcriptase inhibitors, essentially HIV drugs that have been recycled or slightly improved for blocking the reverse transcription step in hepatitis B, or a standard type 1 interferon, which is an immune stimulator but has terrible side effects.
Right.
And generally can only be given for about a year, and neither of them cures very many patients. So people on reverse transcriptase inhibitors, what they call NUCs, nucleoside analogs, generally have to take it for their lifespan.
Right.
There have been occasionally people will go off of it, and some people will get cured, but the cure rate may come off something like 3% or so, very, very small. So most people have to go back on again. Now drug companies have sort of now looking at a huge number of different types of targets within the virus and are making the field very, very exciting because there's all new modalities of therapy that one can test both in animal models, such as humanized mice, transgenic mice that are made that can support the replication of hepatitis B, or all these other type of animal models for hepatitis B. And ultimately, there are clinical trials now going on with a whole variety of new compounds, which is really the fodder for types of work that I do, where I'd like to see what these drugs do and what they're how they're changing the biomarkers, things like the amount of virus that you can measure in someone's blood, or some of the antigens that we associate with hepatitis virus.
Right.
And from their kinetics, not only you can learn something about the drug, but you can also learn something about how the virus interacts with the host immune system, and how it's maybe causing pathogenesis. And I think one of the major examples of that is not so much in hepatitis B, but was in HIV.
Okay.
As you know, HIV infects CD4 cells and causes the depletion, which is why ultimately we have acquired immunodeficiency syndrome.
Yeah, the immune system shuts down.
Shuts down because the CD4 cells are killed.
Yeah.
And that process takes, on average, about 10 years from the time a person's infected with HIV until they have a full-blown clinical AIDS, which means they have this huge amount of CD4 depletion.
Right.
When we started looking at the effects of therapy in HIV, what we were able to deduce is that the cells that get infected actually only live about one day while they're producing virus.
It's amazing.
So what's going on in HIV, and just why this is exciting, just using drug therapy to give you insights into what we call the pathogenesis. This virus is It's very cytopathic. It can, once it gets, starts being produced in the cells, it can kill them very, very rapidly. But also, the bone marrow remains intact for quite a while, and that can just constantly producing more and more blood cells. So you have this constant battle where the virus is killing cells rapidly, and the body's trying to reproduce them rapidly.
It's amazing.
And the drug therapy can, you know, change that balance by preventing the virus from killing cells. So we had great insights into that and a lot of the other processes that are causing the long-term destruction of the immune system. And the hope is to do the same thing in some of these other viral diseases.
So you're generating data that's useful not just for the specific drug or compound that's being studied, but more generally.
To learn about what the virus is doing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, because if you can block some of the things that it's doing, then you have a signal of what it's doing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, thank you, Dr. Perlman. It's good to talk to you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Ploss. I'm a professor in the Department of Molecular Biology at Princeton University.
Terrific. Thank you. Is it co-organizer or co-chair of next year's meeting?
I'm the co-organizer of next year's meeting.
Co-organizer, yeah, okay. We'll save that question for last. Tell me, first of all, about your own work in hepatitis B. What's your particular interest? What does the team in your lab work on?
So my lab is generally interested in human hepatotropic infections, and one focuses on hepatitis B virus. We are interested in aspects of the molecular virology of the virus, particularly how the virus establishes persistence. And we have also a larger research program on understanding host range restrictions with the goal of developing animal models for hepatitis B virus.
Hepatitis B is a pretty unique virus, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned the word persistence. It's a very persistent virus of the human body, isn't it?
Correct. So HBV, once it becomes chronic, cannot be cleared by the human immune system. The mechanisms by which the virus establishes persistence are better understood, not completely. It's in part due to the somewhat unique molecular biology of hepatitis B virus and or failures in the immune response to clear the infection.
I think you mentioned that your lab uses an animal model to study HBV. What animal?
Yeah, there's not a single animal model that is sort of perfect, where you can look at all aspects of hepatitis B virus molecular biology and immunology. So we are trying to come up with new, I guess, innovative ways to establish infections in experimentally more tractable species. So I'm specifically thinking about mice, primate species that are more commonly accessible. But it's challenging because this virus usually infects only humans and great apes, chimpanzees specifically. And yeah, we're trying to, I guess, broaden the species range a little bit.
So even though everyone's all excited about AI and drug development and research, AI is not going to replace the animal model in this kind of work?
Likely not. I think mathematical models and algorithms to predict host responses have gone a long way and have become a lot better. But if you're thinking about understanding pathogenesis, processes that take very long periods of time and have so many different parameters to come in, that's going to be really difficult, at least with the currently available approaches. And then also importantly for drug development, if you think about curative approaches that likely involve multiple different compounds with different mechanisms of actions, you likely have to test those empirically in a mouse model or some animal model.
Well, certainly that makes good sense. And that was on my list of questions. Drug development, where do you see the general environment in drug development for HBV? And does that mean, have scientists pretty much in clinicians concluded that a combination therapy is going to be the answer as opposed to a single drug?
Likely, yes. The challenges are that this virus doesn't have a lot of targets. So if I can maybe compare this to hepatitis C virus, which is sort of one of the big success stories in modern medicine, where basically a combination of drugs can actually cure the infections. The advantage there is that you have multiple enzymes encoded by hepatitis C virus that you can target, and thereby you could come up with a cocktail that is giving you very little side effects. Now, for hepatitis B virus, this virus has only very few gene products, one enzyme that you can go after that has already been targeted with the available therapies, but this doesn't lead to a cure. So likely you have to include multiple different compounds to come up with a combination that would lead to a cure. And likely this has to be also really different modalities. So not just directly acting antivirals or host targeting antivirals, but also immunostimulators to get rid of this virus. So it's complicated.
And the current marketplace, I shouldn't say marketplace, the current research environment in terms of drug development, you know, we've seen companies leave the area of hepatitis B research. Do you think it's discouraging? Do you think it's a trend that's going to be reversed?
Maybe there was a little bit of naivety when I guess some people joined the game here. I think we are all in here for the long game. It will take time because it's so complicated. This virus has such a unique molecular biology, and there's I guess no easy way, no also obvious way that would say, okay, if you do this, then the virus is gone. I wouldn't say it's discouraging, but it is obviously somewhat concerning that large players have abandoned part of their portfolios. It is important that I guess we keep everybody on board. This will really require the community to step up if we're really serious about coming up with a functional cure.
That's interesting you should say that. I could see that after the success with hepatitis C, people in the drug industry might say, oh, there's the next target. Well, let's, if we can cure C, let's go cure B and, have a commercial success. But hepatitis B is a particularly different and great challenge. Is that true?
That is correct. I think there's also was the thinking maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago that it would be basically the next big thing. It's definitely a much bigger market in terms of, number of infected people. But as I tried to explain before, the virus is significantly more challenging and offers fewer targets to go after. So that's definitely creates problems when you come up with sort of the traditional way of drug development. So here, I think we have to be also less or more risk-taking when it comes to the approaches that we are considering, keeping in mind that we obviously don't want to subject any patients to any harmful therapies, but it will likely be something else than just a combination of directly acting antivirals.
Is there any particular new track in research in hepatitis B, whether it's drug development or more basic research? Is there anything in particular that you find especially exciting?
So I joined this field about 10 years ago, and we know of this virus for more than 5 decades. So there's 40 years to catch up with. And what is really interesting to me is, how much was already known, but there's also now a lot of new methodologies, new players in the field who basically have increased our knowledge, maybe also came up with ways to explain mechanistically some of the observations that were already made a number of years ago. I think there are a number of really exciting new developments with respect to technologies, new ways to study the virus, whether it's new cell culture models, animal models that are on the rise. So I'm very optimistic that we can learn a lot more about the biology and ultimately also learn enough that would enable us to come up with a cure.
Good to hear you say that. People do get concerned at times about the state of the drug development pipeline and research, and we cured hepatitis C, why not B? That kind of discussion. And people are also concerned about funding for research. Do you think hepatitis B is particularly underfunded, or is it more general, the funding challenge in science, basically?
Yeah, thanks for asking this question. Yes, I'd say given the magnitude of the problem, generally hepatitis research is underfunded, whether it's in the US or globally. We are definitely grateful for the support that we have received from the NIH, for example, NIAID. But I think a lot more is needed, and that includes, dedicated programs at the federal level, additionally foundation funding, and also industry that can probably benefit quite a bit from activities that are ongoing in academia, for example, where particular essays, methods become available that are probably too hard to implement for some, to establish them, make them accessible, more accessible to a broader community. So yes, I think continued research, continued funding for research will be imperative to really tackle this problem. This is not a, there's no quick way of doing it. And unfortunately, it will likely take a few more years till we get to a point where we can say, okay, this is really the Achilles heel for this virus. And this is how we have to go about to get rid of it.
That's interesting. People outside of the scientific community and the drug industry naturally are suspicious of drug industry collaboration with university scientists as though that's something to be concerned about. But there is value, isn't there?
Definitely. You know, we have phenomenal colleagues who work in the for-profit space. They bring in, you know, deep expertise and also resources that are not available in academia. But that being said, usually there isn't maybe the time and also the interest to dig deep enough and maybe work on a given problem for a number of years to figure out, let's say, a particular mechanism or come up with a new way of studying the virus. So there, I think, comes in the added benefit from collaborations with academicians. Since, you know, we are not necessarily bound to, I guess, goals set forth by stakeholders or shareholders or someone who tries to make a profit off a drug for this virus.
Yeah, I understand. I came out of the drug industry in New Jersey recently, and I know that well. And lastly, you're one of the co-organizers, one of the two co-organizers of next year's HBV meeting, which will be in Chicago. You haven't really begun planning yet, I'm sure, but what are your thoughts about next year in Chicago?
Yeah, first of all, Matteo Iannacconi and I will be co-organizing this meeting. I'm really excited and honored that I guess we can organize the 2024 HBV meeting. We did start, I guess, with the planning. This is a lengthy process. We picked a meeting site in Chicago, and we are really excited to have the entire community over back in the US. I believe it's for the 18th time. And this should be a fantastic meeting, and really hope to get everybody there in person.
Information about the 2024 International HBV meeting, set for September in Chicago, will be available soon on the meeting website. That is www.hbvmeeting.org. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please subscribe for future episodes about Hepatitis B. If you have any questions, please direct them to info@hepb.org. You can support our programs at the Hepatitis B Foundation by going to www.hepb.org/donate or click on the links provided on this page. We appreciate your support. Stay tuned for more episodes.